I have the honor of introducing two fascinating people. I've never met them, but I'm here to introduce them, and I'm going to tell you why. They live in New Mexico, and they both, again, I refer to Kathleen and Bill Christensen. They worked for the CIA and our federal government. And they became very knowledgeable about world events and places around the world. And they have had a most interesting life. And they are well known nationally on through various media of their views on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And I think they're going to be very helpful to this conference. Bill Christensen was with the CIA for 28 years. He ended up retiring in 1979. In fact, they both retired in 1979 from the CIA. But his last position was the director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis, an office that had 200 persons. And these were experts on all nations, regions, and global problems of the world. Kathleen also was in the CIA as an analyst, and she focused her work on Vietnam. Then the last 7 years, she concentrated on the Middle East. Now, so what I was asked recently to introduce them, my expectation was that they would show up in trench coats and dark glasses. And so I'm still expecting them to come, but I've just finished Kathleen's book that was written I think it was 1999. It was an edition that I got, which was published in 2001, and it's called Perceptions of Palestine. And I would recommend to anyone who wants history of the United States' involvement in the Israel-Palestine crisis, to read this. It focuses on why does the United States, and why has the United States since the beginning of the 20th century, had a set of blinders on that prevents our leaders from recognizing the concerns of the people who've always been there, the Palestinians. And obviously, Jewish people have also been there. But after the creation of the state of Israel, the blinders on U.S. politicians became even more stronger. The book is very telling and certainly addresses the question that Bishop Reichel raised today. Is this politics? And having been involved in politics and having contacted our local senators and or national senators and our representatives from Congress, we have a problem. This book explains why. It's well written from the standpoint that it treats everybody on an equal footing with great respect and gives a fair shot, gives each person who's in this book a fair and reasonable review, and I think it was very informative. So it is my honor to welcome Kathleen and Bill Christensen.
We appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today and to talk to you, and I want to start with a statement that is right on the cover of what you gave us earlier this morning. What does justice require of the United States? And us is capitalized, obviously means both you and me, and it obviously means the United States of America. The problem with that latter statement is it sort of implies a unity inside the United States that simply does not exist today, hasn't for a long time, and what, in my opinion, we need to do is to treat the basic problem of the Palestinian issue more as a domestic, internal political issue in the United States than a foreign policy issue. Obviously, the results come out in our foreign policy, but what we have is such disunity inside the United States that this becomes a major domestic political issue which is being decided on a daily basis through what we call lobbying. Lobbying is one of the key critical issues we have to deal with here today, and there simply is no getting around it. Now, when we talk, we are often told, look, you talk about lobbies and you say that this is one of the critical problems. Well, don't you realize that the problem is really you, that is meaning me or meaning Kathy or meaning others who think the way we tend to think. You are just simply not good enough lobbyists. You become more skillful. You can be just as good a lobby as the Israel lobby is today. And that, to me, avoids the biggest part of the problem. We don't need to do just become better lobbyists on our own. We need to have laws, new laws, that control the amount of lobbying that may be done, because every bit of lobbying on any issue, on tobacco, on health care, and on Palestine-Israel, every bit of lobbying costs an immense amount of money, and unless you have that immense amount of money, you cannot lobby as effectively as someone who does have an immense amount of money. Now, the Israel lobby consists of pretty much the entire U.S. military industrial complex, which makes money year after year, every single year, by providing arms to Israel to the tune of $3 billion, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more. That profit comes from other U.S. funds which are given, not lent, to Israel. And that's where a lot of the money comes from that makes the Israel lobby so powerful. There's just is no question about that. So what I want to urge, number one, right here, is that new laws have got to be passed limiting lobbying in the United States. And what has happened instead is our side of this issue, has simply lost another big round in the past month with the newest decision of the U.S. Supreme Court saying that corporations, just as people, have every right to spend every cent they want to spend on lobbying, and nothing should prevent that from happening. Well, that's exactly what we have to fight against, because every penny spent on lobbying means a little teeny bit less meaningful democracy in this country. If you have enough money to do what you want with tobacco, that is not what a majority of people in the country wants. If you have enough money to spend or not spend, or to keep out as profits and dealing with the health care issue, again, you can win your case if you have more money to spend, and corporations do have more money to spend. That's all I want to say on that. And Kathy is going to talk much more about what we see as massive injustices toward the Palestinians and mistreatment of the Palestinians in all recent months and years, and how we came to conclude that there just is absolutely no balance in the amount of justice granted to the right-wing Israeli governments now in comparison with the amount of justice granted to the Palestinians. And one of the things, of course, that we're all aware of is that in the 23 days of warfare against Gaza back a little over a year ago now, 1,400 Palestinians lost their lives, and maybe 12 or 13 or 15 or 20 Israelis lost their lives. 1,300, okay. 13, if you have an exact figure, I'll accept that. Okay. But that's a good indication of the difference between the two sides in all areas, and Kathy will give you a lot more details on that. I'm going to be very brief from here on, because I simply want to point out that every single issue in the Middle East and Central Asia is inevitably closely related to the Palestine-Israel issue in so many ways that you could spend hours talking about how they are related. And I want to limit myself to talking about one, which is the matter of Iran, simply because starting right now or starting a few weeks ago and covering the next maybe 1, 2, 3 months, the issue of Iran, which, as I say, is closely related, as many other issues are, to the Israel-Palestine issue, that's going to come to the fore. There is real danger that there will be warfare occurring, either initiated by the United States or initiated by the Israelis, and it's absolutely essential that there be no war rising in Iran in coming weeks and months. It can so easily turn into a nuclear war. It can so easily become a new world war that I think the predictions of what would then happen are almost meaningless, because they are so unclear and so dangerous. And what I want to point out is that Iran, in my humble opinion, would never give up its desire for nuclear weapons. And I think they do. I think that the present Iranian government does have a real desire, although they deny this, to have nuclear weapons. Iran will never give up that desire permanently unless and until Israel and the United States take some positive actions to give up their own nuclear weapons. Now, you can sit here and you can clap for that, and I appreciate that. Many people in this room probably are also sitting there saying, look, that's never going to happen. Israel is never going to give up its nuclear weapons. Well, let me tell you this. I think it is just as realistic to press for some sort of elimination of nuclear weapons by all nations in the world as it is to go to war, very possibly using nuclear weapons against Iran, because the consequences of that are also totally unrealistic and totally wrong. So I just want to emphasize again, this issue right now is more important, in my opinion, than what happens inside Palestine or what happens to U.S. policy toward Palestine in coming weeks and months, because there is simply no way that it would be right and proper for the United States and or Israel to start that kind of new war, which already there are actions being taken by the U.S. trying to bring about regime change in Iran. If you are in a government that you know some other government is trying to change, that becomes a serious existential matter. And I think, to me, it is perfectly appropriate that a country such as Iran, 10 times or so larger in both area and population than Israel, if it decides it wants to have its own deterrent, and that is what I'm sure the Iranian government really wants. It is not going to, just when it gets one or two nuclear weapons, going to attack Israel or going to attack the United States, because it knows it would be simply ruined by the retaliation. What Iran wants is a deterrent of its own, and the history of the last 50 years will tell you that countries which obtain their own deterrent may be criticized a little bit by the U.S., but you know, all during the last half of the 1950s and the 60s, when I was working directly on this problem in Washington, Israeli governments totally lied time after time after time. No, we're never going to develop nuclear weapons. That thing down there by Dimona, that's a textile plant, or that's this other kind of plant. They lied. India lied as it was developing nuclear weapons. Pakistan lied as it was developing nuclear weapons. No country is going to get up there and confess that it's working on nuclear weapons as long as it can make any kind of even unrealistic case that it is not developing nuclear weapons until it has them. So I think this is an issue which this conference has to deal with, as well as more directly the Palestine-Israel issue. And now I'd like to turn this over to Kathy to get us back to what maybe many people would call reality, but I'm calling the Iran war something which must be treated realistically. Thank you very much.
Bill said that I was going to talk about injustices to the Palestinians, and I think about that all the time. We're actually going to talk more directly about that in our workshop, which follows our workshop, which follows this plenary. There are other workshops as well. I am going to talk more, as Bill started to about the Israel lobby in the United States and the U.S.-Israeli partnership. Taking off in some ways from the book that our introducer very nicely mentioned, Perceptions of Palestine, which is a history of U.S. policymaking on the Palestinian issue. I'd been looking for an anecdote that would dramatically illustrate the extent and nature of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, as Bill and I have been started to call it, the U.S.-Israeli partnership, and an anecdote that would make you all perk up your ears and keep you awake at mid-morning. A good one dropped in my lap just a little while ago. It comes from a blog called Mondo Weiss, which is written by Philip Weiss. Weiss is a very is an excellent blogger. He's a Jewish journalist who writes a lot about Jewish identity, its connection to Zionism, his own feelings about Zionism, and the connection of all this to the politics and policymaking in the United States. Over the last few years, it's actually been possible to watch him move along the spectrum from Zionist, although he says he's never been a Zionist, but I think he was, to non-Zionist and very close to anti-Zionist. I don't think he would call himself an anti-Zionist, but he's getting close. He has also come to be very critical of the pro-Israel lobby and its influence on U.S. policy. He wrote a blog post a couple of months ago with a headline that seemed to advocate the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine. I'm not exactly actually sure where he stands on the virtues of two states in Palestine versus one state, but he has definitely not been a strong advocate of two states the way the Obama administration has, for instance, or the new Jewish lobby group, J Street, or other pro-Israeli Zionist peace groups like the Jewish organization Brit Tzedek has. But it quickly became clear that Weiss was not talking about the two-state solution as we all know it. He was talking about what he termed the incredible conflation of American and Israeli interests that the neocons in the Bush administration, and in fact many people in the Obama administration as well, have pushed in U.S. discourse. He gave several examples, and he ended his post by saying that he thought the special relationship with Israel has hurt the U.S. in the Middle East, which I think is indisputable, and he called for disentangling the relationship. And this was his last sentence: separation, partition, call it what you will, but the U.S. and Israel need to be two states, not one. Two states, not one. And he's, as I said, he's not talking about Israel and Palestine. He's talking about the U.S. and Israel. Now, that's dramatic, I think, and very thought-provoking. And thank you. A good response from this audience. To have a serious Jewish journalist who devotes his entire time, his entire blog, to probing the realities and the consequences of the U.S. partnership with Israel, to have him conclude that there is a very harmful identity of interests is very, very striking. Now, how did this identity of interests and the uniquely strong U.S. tie to Israel arise? There are actually, as I'm sure most of you know, there are two schools of thought on the question of how that tie arose and the importance of the Israel lobby in influencing U.S. policy and cementing the U.S.-Israeli relationship. One is led by Noam Chomsky, among others, but he's probably the leading spokesman of this school. It holds that U.S. interests are cynically determined by the so-called political ruling class made up of the elites of the military corporate government complex, and that these interests, which may or may not in fact be the true interests of the American people, actually are identical with Israeli interests. But this is the important part of their advocacy, I think, of this school of thought's advocacy. This school of thought believes that Israel is a strategic asset of the United States that serves U.S. imperialism, and that because the U.S. sets the policy and Israel follows U.S. orders, the lobby has only minimal influence on policymaking. Now, the other school, of which Bill and I are advocates, holds that the lobby plays a vitally important role in determining the direction of U.S. policy in the Middle East, particularly in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and that the lobby cements the U.S.-Israeli relationship. We don't at all discount, as Bill made clear a minute ago, the influence of the military-industrial complex, which obviously has a voice in policymaking, since it makes the weapons with which we arm Israel to the tune, as Bill said, of at least $3 billion a year. And this military-industrial complex makes the weapons that the U.S. itself uses in its own wars, now quite extensive, against Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and so on. So we don't dismiss the power of the military-industrial complex, we too, and this school of thought. In fact, there is such an interweaving of political and arms industry interests and such a convergence of U.S. and Israeli efforts toward global and regional Middle East domination that it's impossible to minimize the importance of these special interests in determining U.S. policy. We just feel, unlike the other school of thought, that the influence the Israel lobby exerts has been critically important, and we feel there is a mountain of evidence to support this view. We're in good company in putting forth this view. You're probably all aware of the groundbreaking book published a couple of years ago by the scholars John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, entitled The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. A superb analysis, we both think, of the ways in which the lobby exerts its power and influence. Mearsheimer and Walt came up with a particularly good definition of what they mean by lobby, one with which we totally agree. They say the lobby is a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that actively works to move U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. I want to repeat that. The lobby is, in their definition, a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that actively works to move U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. This is a perfect, comprehensive definition. First, they say it's a loose coalition of individuals and organizations. The lobby is not, as many people believe, just AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the main lobby organization, but definitely not the only means by which pro-Israel influence is exerted. There are other organizations as well. There are also individuals who exert influence. The neocons, for example, during the Bush administration. Now, there is an example of individuals who made up a lobby right inside an administration, and they basically ran Bush administration policy on the Middle East. There is also, and to my mind, this is critical, a common public discourse fashioned by Israeli advocates that has a strong, strong influence on policy formulation. I'll talk about that more in a minute. The other part of the Mearsheimer-Walt definition is also very important. This loose coalition, as they say, actively works to move U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. They don't say, as defenders of Israel have charged, that the Israel lobby controls all U.S. policy or even controls U.S. Middle East policy. The lobby, individuals as well as organizations, simply works hard to move policy in a pro-Israel direction. Sometimes it doesn't succeed, sometimes it's defeated, which is why control is not the right word. But the lobby most certainly does work to move policy in a pro-Israel direction, and it's successful more often than not. The examples are myriad, but most important, I think, is the pro-Israel discourse that I mentioned a moment ago, a mindset and a set of assumptions that determine how we all automatically think about Israel when we hear the name mentioned, what we all think when we hear the name Palestinians mentioned. This is a public discourse, a mindset that has been building and being shaped and being internalized for almost a century, since well before Israel was created. Mark Braverman, whose marvelous book, Fatal Embrace, is over there to be sold, talks quite a lot about the discourse and how it shapes all of U.S. public thinking. His emphasis is on Jewish public thinking, but it affects the U.S. public generally. And this mindset has a huge impact on how policymakers, how every policymaker approaches the Arab-Israeli issue, and particularly the Palestinian-Israeli issue. I'm talking about every policymaker in every administration since the Zionist enterprise began promoting itself in the United States around World War I. let me start at the beginning, and don't worry, I won't go into too much detail, but in terms of making U.S. policy on the issue of Palestine and the Zionists, Woodrow Wilson was the first president to make a policy decision on Palestine, and he did it at the instigation and under the influence of the first Zionist lobbyist in the U.S., Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Brandeis spent some time in Britain consulting with the British government, actually lobbying, about its support for Zionism. And in 1917, when the British issued the Balfour Declaration, promising support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine, Brandeis used his easy access to Wilson, they were friends and political colleagues, to press for U.S. support for that declaration. His intercession was of inestimable, I'm glad I could pronounce that word without too much of a stumble, real value in setting U.S. policy on a course that has never in any significant way deviated from strong support for Zionism and ultimately for Israel. Zionist lobbying in those early days did not stop with Brandeis. There were other Zionist activists in key positions to influence, able to influence policy and influence Congress. And even in this early period, American Zionists proved to be skilled, well-organized, very dedicated, and numerous enough to get the job done. They mounted a multi-pronged effort, simultaneously attempting to shape the views of the media through frequent, well-placed media stories, of Congress through direct lobbying that resulted in pro-Zionist resolutions even back then, of the political establishment through more direct lobbying that resulted in pro-Zionist statements in both the Republican and the Democratic Party platforms from the 1920s on, of the public through media placement and demonstrations that continually brought the Zionist project to public attention, and of key policymakers, including presidents, through personal contact, and I'm talking about this early period, up through the Roosevelt and the Truman administrations. The effort was very sophisticated, and it was incredibly effective. I don't want to go into much more detail here, but the point is that these early efforts essentially determined public and policymaker thinking for all succeeding periods and administrations. It quickly became automatic, almost rote, for policymakers to view the Palestine situation from a totally Zionist perspective, to assume that because the U.S. had supported a Jewish homeland during the Wilson administration, that set policy forever. No one ever questioned the policy. No one ever asked what Zionism meant for the Palestinians. This atmosphere was reinforced by already existing disdain for Arabs and Muslims and was obviously further solidified by the huge outpouring, justifiable outpouring, of sympathy for Jews in the aftermath of the Holocaust. Along the way, several very effective Zionist groups worked to mobilize public support for the Zionist enterprise, which in turn influenced the views of the media and ultimately of policymakers. This is what I mean by a public discourse and a frame of reference that are totally pro-Zionist and now pro-Israeli. The mindset was more or less set in concrete by the time Harry Truman had to make a decision on supporting statehood for Israel. He actually had misgivings about a state based on a religion, but he was subject to such heavy lobbying by Zionist advocates, and he had a great deal of sympathy for the Jews and their situation in the aftermath of the Holocaust. He was subject to heavy lobbying and had this sympathy that he ultimately gave in to the formation of a Jewish state and support for a Jewish state. There were lobby pressures from outside the White House, but even more importantly, his three closest White House aides lobbied strongly and very emotionally for Israel. So Truman went along with them, even though, and this is very important to note, all of his national security advisors at the time, military and political, were totally opposed to the creation of a Jewish state on the grounds that this would disadvantage the United States in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, that it would endanger U.S. access to the Middle East's oil resources, and that it could lead to war. Now that was prophetic. And it has been ever thus. Over the years since Israel's creation, there has been a pervasive atmosphere in which Israel is simply assumed to be so close to the United States, its interests so closely intertwined with American interests, that it is accepted almost as a part of the United States. The lobby reinforces this sentiment, maintaining it in a myriad of ways and channeling it into institutional ways of involving ordinary Americans in supporting Israel. The labor movement is one example. The Christian right is another example. It is obviously, as I'm sure it won't be any secret to us, a major source of support for Israel. Christian Zionists strongly support Israel's continued existence and its continued control over the occupied Palestinian territories as the essential prerequisite to the so-called millennium, when they believe Jesus Christ will reappear. During the last, this has been going on for a century, but it, particularly in the last few years, maybe two decades, in particular, the Christian right has used its vast numbers to lobby both the administration and Congress in support of Israel's policies and in opposition to any proposal that would require Israeli concessions. I don't know if you recently heard Sarah Palin gave a talk at the Teabag Convention in somewhere in Tennessee 2 weeks ago, and during her talk she wore a lapel pin with United States and Israeli flags intertwined. That's how important Israel is to the Christian right. Former Senator James Aberesk, who is of Arab descent, Lebanese, and represented South Dakota in the 1970s, recently described how this atmosphere of required support for Israel operates inside political circles. The support Israel enjoys in Congress, he said, is based completely on political fear, a fear that anyone who does not do what Israel wants done will be defeated by the lobby. This pressure creates a kind of self-censorship that silences criticism of Israel, and this silence imposed by the lobby ripples down the line, even beyond Congress. Even one congressional critic who speaks out is attacked by the lobby, Aberesk said, quote, on the grounds that if Congress is completely silent on the issue, the press will have no one to quote, which effectively silences the press as well. Any journalists or editors who step out of line are quickly brought under control by well-organized economic pressure against the newspaper caught sinning, unquote. This kind of silencing has a direct impact on policy formulation, and it also has a longer-term, more indirect impact, because this is the atmosphere in which future policymakers grow up. An atmosphere of ignorance and denial, and Israel can do no wrong, in which it is virtually impossible, first of all, to learn anything about the situation, and secondly, to speak out without incurring the organized wrath of Israel's supporters through mass letter-writing campaigns, media criticism, charges of anti-Semitism, and heavy pressure from Congress. Not many politicians are willing to risk this. Not many ordinary people are willing to risk it either. And I think, unfortunately, Barack Obama's behavior during his first year in office, calling on Israel to impose a settlement freeze in the West Bank, but then backing down meekly, I would have to say, when Israel and its lobby supporters here said no, dramatically illustrates the strong, strong influence that Israel and the lobby exert in determining U.S. policy on this critical issue. There's no denying the importance of the U.S. military-industrial-financial complex or the intricate interweaving of this conglomerate with Israel's military, industrial, and financial interests, as Noam Chomsky and others on the left contend. But rather than a relationship in which Israel does the bidding of the United States, in reality the entanglement is much more one between two independent players. The relationship is symbiotic. It's important that independent, I mean in terms of power. The partnership makes them practically one, as I said at the beginning. The relationship is symbiotic. It's important to keep in mind when someone says that Israel always does the U.S. bidding, that Israel and its lobby have been the policy initiators And the U.S. has been the follower in Israel's 1967 war, its 1982 invasion of Lebanon, its 2002 invasion of the West Bank, its 40-plus year settlement construction enterprise in the occupied Palestinian territories, its disproportionate attacks on Palestinians, its assault on Lebanon in 2006, and its assault on Gaza last year. Israel started all of those actions, policies, and the United States followed. The military-industrial complex may have benefited, and undoubtedly did, economically from these wars or some of these wars, but it did not initiate them. Israel initiated them. The Israel lobby supported them and worked to ensure U.S. support for them. The lobby set the policy and the atmosphere and the discourse that have shaped the official U.S. stance that has always enabled Israel's aggression against Palestinians and other Arabs. As I said, the two players are independent actors operating very, very closely as partners. I don't need to tell this audience how dismal is the U.S. image throughout the Arab world and Muslim world because of our unquestioning support for everything Israel does. I only want to be clear that it is primarily the Israel lobby that ultimately has shaped this terrible image. The tragedy of the present situation is that it has become impossible to separate Israeli interests from the selfish so-called national interests of the military political corporate complex that in conjunction with the lobby dominates both political parties in the United States. This perceived convergence of interests has a profound effect on U.S. policy choices in the Middle East. If the United States is unable to distinguish its own real needs and the world's from those of another state and that state's lobby, then it simply cannot say that it always acts in its own best interests. In the face of the massive human rights violations being committed against Palestinians today, the failure to recognize this reality is where those who belittle the lobby's power and accept U.S. Middle East policy as simply an unchangeable part of a longstanding imperialist strategy are particularly dangerous. Thank you. I want to talk about the billboard. Thank you. What we would like to do if for our remaining 10 or 15 minutes is leave this open to discussion and questions from you. But I also want to make an announcement. I hope this will be short and introduce someone else. We come from New Mexico and we live in Santa Fe, but in Albuquerque there's a new about a year old organization called the Coalition to Stop $30 billion to Israel. This refers to the current aid package to Israel, which grants the United States grants Israel $30 billion of totally military aid over the next 10 years. It started in the Bush administration in 2007. The first $3 billion annual increment of it was 2008. Obama just signed over the second annual increment, and we have 8 more years to go. Of $3 billion a year. This organization in Albuquerque, among other things it's done, the major thing it did, though, was set up a series initially of 10 billboards around town in Israel, in Albuquerque. And the message, the message was, stop killing children. It had a picture of an Israeli tank on one side, a Palestinian little girl dressed in a Palestinian dress on the other side. And it was, the message initially was, stop killing children. And, Brian, what was it? End 30 billion. End the 30 billion to Israel. It stayed up, the billboards, 10 billboards around town, small billboards, stayed up for, I don't know, maybe a week, something like that. And then the lobby got after the billboard company, and all of the billboards were torn down. Now, after much effort and much searching for a billboard company that would take these billboards, there has been one larger billboard set up again just a month or two ago in Albuquerque, with a slightly toned down message about same pictures, about using our tax dollars on us Americans instead of to give Israel $30 billion. And the reason I mention all this is that there is right here in Seattle, sitting in the front row, a gentleman named Brian Sario, Dr. Brian Sario, who is trying to start a similar billboard campaign in Seattle. And he is going to, Brian is, why don't you at least raise your hand? That's what he looks like during the lunch period, in the lunchroom. Brian is going to try to hand out some things, including pictures of our original billboard from Albuquerque and some other literature, and has a sign-up sheet and so on, and trying to enlist some support from Seattle people. And I would also like to tell Brian that sitting over there on the other side of that aisle, a couple of rows behind you, is a man and a woman named Michael and Marianne Poulin, is that right? Who are from Spokane, have done billboards. So you all should meet each other. So thank you. And I hope a lot of people sign up with Brian's effort. So we would take questions now.
I'd like to add one word on these billboards. In Albuquerque, I don't know whether this is coincidence or has more meaning than that, but in Albuquerque there exists a group of Palestinians who really thought the billboards were the most important thing that anyone could do to advertise the Palestinian cause. A lot of us ordinary Anglo types had a belief at first, well, gee, these billboards cost a lot of money, and who knows really whether they do much good or not. But where you find a group of Palestinians being really enthusiastic, Palestinians in this country, being really enthusiastic to do one particular thing, you better listen to them, because they are the ones whom this will help the very most.
Let me just add that these are not only Palestinians, but there's a mosque, a fairly new mosque in Albuquerque, and quite a substantial Muslim community, which is broader based than just Palestinians. And it was many of the donations came from the Muslim community in general. But Bill is right about the dedication of the Palestinians.
I think we do have time for maybe two or three questions. I would ask that they be questions and not statements. So we can really learn from our speakers. We also have a roving mic here. So I'll start here.
I would like to ask if you know anything about Mark Grossman, who was third in command at the State Department, and his involvement with Turkish selling of nuclear weapons to Pakistan of our nature, of that was ours. Do you know anything about that?
I didn't know about his involvement with Turkey or nuclear weapons or anything. I think he was, and I don't know a whole lot about him, but I believe he was, was he not a spokesman or an official in AIPAC, the main lobby organization, before, a few years ago anyway, before he was hired on by Hillary Clinton at the State Department. So I don't know a lot about him, but I think that here we have another lobbyist in the government, and that's all I really know. So, and I don't unfortunately know about the Turkey and nuclear business.
Question?
Yes, Tim Hill just mentioned the book that you have written in 2001. How do we get this book? And I understand there's not so many copies of it. But on the other hand, I know that you have published a new book just a month ago, which is called Palestine in Pieces. And I think maybe somebody should say about it rather than the old book. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The new book is Palestine in Pieces, co-authored by the two of us, and there's a stack of them over there, which include we will recover our cost on these books, but the extra above our cost will go to Sabeel. And we have also included with the book, this is a book about the occupation, We wanted people, it's basically a primer on the occupation with a lot of pictures. They're published in black and white, and we wanted people to be able to see them in color. So we have also included a CD with each book with the pictures in color.
I'd like to emphasize also something else about this new book. We have been to Palestine 8 times, each time for 3 weeks or a month since 2003, and now we've come back to the United States. We'll go back to Palestine many more times, but anyway, we go to Palestine a number of times, come back, and write a book. And we thought long and hard after we had written this book, what should we do? Because on the one hand, and this really affected us, you write a book capitalizing on what is a tragedy to the Palestinian people. And we decided that that wasn't really what we wanted to do. So we have decided to give any profits at all from this book. Kathy and I are going to give to one of several, or maybe two or three or more, Palestinian organizations, which in our opinion are doing the most actually to help the Palestinian people. We felt that was the only way we ought to handle this new book that we have written, and should not try to capitalize in any way and make money on this book.
Let me just add, in answer to your first question, the earlier book, Perceptions of Palestine, is still in print. It's available on Amazon. It's published by the University of California Press. It's not as cheap as this one, but it's pretty cheap, so.
What Kathy's not saying is she ought to be writing a new edition of this book. And she will one of these days.
It's about U.S. policy up through the Clinton administration. Well, now I have 8 years of Bush administration to include such a monumental change that, yeah, so, okay.
I have two brief questions, and I'll ask them both, and then I'd like to hear from you. The connection or the support of the military-industrial complex for sending weapons to Israel is a pretty clear one to understand, and I've recognized that for every $1 billion of weapons we give them, we create $20 to $50 billion worth of problems. So it's really not $3 billion benefit to the military-industrial complex, probably more like $50 billion. So comment on that. And then I'm reading a great three-volume book by Alan Hart, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. And
here's the second volume.
This is fantastic. In the first volume, it comments during the Truman administration, prior to the creation of the state, there was 400,000 immigration permits available that had not been allocated during the war because immigration was restricted. There was a congressional law proposed to give all 400,000 permits to the Jews in Europe to come to America, and the Zionist lobby defeated that. Would you comment on that? Thank you.
If I could comment very quickly on Alan Hart's book at the start of this, while I still remember it. We met him and talked with him at length just a couple of months ago. We spent 15 days or so in England giving talks on our new book, and he and we were both happened to be on Press TV, which is an Iranian, sort of a Iranian VOA, while we were there. That's how we met him, and then we had a dinner together with him. And he really knows an awful lot, and he has three volumes. This is volume two, which has just come out in the U.S. We've also read volume one. Volume three is coming out in June. And if you are interested and can make the time to read three entire volumes, it is, I think, a super fine book. But you gotta have a lot of time. And many of us I know don't have that kind of time. It's good though. Yeah, look, The entire U.S.-Israeli partnership is extraordinarily beneficial in dozens of different ways to the Israeli smaller military-industrial complex. They both make a lot of money off of this, and this is where so much of the money that goes to the Israel lobby comes from. Almost all of it starts with money provided for free by the United States government. That is how powerful this lobby is, and I would never want to minimize it by talking exclusively about $3 billion a year. That's the half of it.
I wasn't aware of your specific example you read, because I haven't read Alan Hart's book yet that you mentioned. But I know there was a lot of manipulation of permits and placement of the displaced peoples after World War II in Europe, mostly Jews. For instance, with the help of the lobby, the U.S. was, I believe, induced to move a lot of the Jewish refugees into U.S.-controlled zones, out of Soviet-controlled zones, so that it would be easier to then allow them to go to Israel. So there was a lot of manipulation. And also there was some of the right-wing Zionist organizations from Israel, the Likud, the precursor of the Likud, for instance, cooperate to some extent with the Nazis in order to try to get Jews and move them to Palestine. So there was some cooperation with the Nazis, but my detailed knowledge is not that good.
This U.S.-Israeli partnership, and we both use that word very deliberately to get away from the point of who controls whom. Neither controls the other. They're both independent, as Kathy emphasized. But it results in weekly or monthly at the most meetings in practically every single industry that Israel has an interest, meetings between their personnel and our personnel. Santa Fe, New Mexico, where we live, is only 30-40 miles from Los Alamos, which is where the U.S. has one of its biggest nuclear installations in the entire country. We know there are Israelis working at Los Alamos, and here you have a situation where the Israelis haven't even announced openly to the world that they have nuclear weapons. We are taking them in to Los Alamos, and some of the people who work in Los Alamos have talked to us very briefly about this, but it's kept under very tight wraps, and anybody who were known to be talking to us about this would be in quite serious trouble. So I'll stop there.
Thank you to both Kathy and Bill for giving us this presentation, clear understanding. Just stay here for a second.